found in the B-Stars belt and current orbits of the remaining planets. While it does so, I'm going to take a shuttle into that belt and collect some samples. If we are ever going to determine how DK1116 came to be where and what it is, we are going to have to understand how this system was created.
Not alone, you aren't.
Every other member of this crew is either at their post, on the surface, or preparing to go to the surface.
Take Gwyn.
Seven sighed. I'd really rather not.
She's our best pilot short of Tom Paris. She'll get you there and back in no time.
I expect the mission to collect all we need might take several days. I would hate for Gwyn to miss her rotation on shore leave.
You can have her for 2 days. She got pulled from the first away team for medical reasons.
She's ill?
No. Dr. Sherrick needed her for something, so we had to rearrange the schedule at the last minute. She's fine. In fact, this will be a nice distraction for her while she's waiting her turn.
Are there any other pilots available?
Kim searched his memory. Gleese.
If you insist, I'll take Gwyn, Seven said, resigned. She is intemperate, but competent.
Gleese is competent.
As long as we're in orbit.
Kim would have been insulted on poor Gleese's behalf if Seven hadn't had a point. Perhaps some time alone with you would do him good. He might benefit from a little training while you're out there in the asteroid belt collecting your samples.
You do realize that you can't order me to take anyone with me.
That's true, but I can deny your request to use a shuttle.
You wouldn't.
But I can. Come on, Seven, it's a safety issue and you know it. Kim's eyes narrowed, daring her to defy him.
Very well, Seven said, knowing when she was beaten.
Very well, what? Her face lost all traces of amusement.
Very well, Captain.
Vesta.
Ensign Atar Gwyn stared at Dr. Sal's face, wondering why when the doctor spoke, all she heard was her mother's voice asking the same question.
The first what? Gwyn asked.
What was the first day of your last cycle? Her mother repeated, all the while wearing Sal's face. A sick pit knotted itself in Gwyn's stomach. It had been a little more than a week. Since then, she'd shared her bed twice with Ensign Gary Blonde. He was one of the fleet's recent additions.
A stellar cartographer, maybe? No. An aeroponics engineer?
She couldn't honestly remember. Gwyn never chose her partners for their professional skills or conversational abilities. In most cases, all she required was a reasonably satisfying way to pass the time. Both times she had taken appropriate protective measures. Neither encounter had been particularly earth-shattering. For a horrifying moment, the rest of her life as Mrs. Ensign Gary Blonde played out in slow motion. She remembered well the first time she'd lived this particular nightmare. Her final year of second-tier studies had just been completed. Three of her best friends had already applied to Starfleet Academy and been accepted. Despite being their intellectual peer, Gwyn had never shown the slightest interest or inclination to pursue that path. She honestly had no idea what she might do with the rest of her life, but on Krios, as on any other Federation world, the only limits placed on possibility were in her imagination. The only thing she knew for sure was that whatever she ended up doing, it would be in close proximity to Jerrick Lore. She didn't remember a time when they hadn't known each other. She'd been too young to create long-term memories when they'd first started playing together. As they grew, always attending the same local tiers, they'd been more or less close as their emotional and physical development dictated. She had plenty of memories of the awkward years in mid-tier when they'd known they were friends, but weren't allowed to show it for fear of merciless teasing from their friends.
Jerrick and Atar, hand in hand, down by the creek bed, kissing in the sand.
She could still hear the sing-song torments only children of a certain age found amusing. Finally, when second tier began, it was suddenly socially acceptable to start pairing off, if not mandatory, in order to maintain social status. And so they had. For 3 years, off and on, they'd been the closest and most envied couple among their friends.
They'd done everything first, including the normal explorations that inevitably led to sex. Everyone knew, especially Atar and Jarek, that they were going to spend the rest of their lives together. That certainty remained until the moment, not long after their commencement ceremonies, while they were both still gripped by the heady intoxication of total freedom absent any real responsibilities, when Atar realized that she'd missed a cycle. She'd never really bothered to keep track, but it didn't matter. The math hadn't alerted her to the potential problem. Something else had. It was hard to describe, especially to anyone who wasn't Creosian. It was a sudden awareness, one morning over breakfast, that she wasn't alone in her body. Another presence had joined her in the night. It wasn't exactly frightening. It felt normal, in the most abnormal way possible. It had also apparently been written all over her face, because the split second her eyes locked with her mother's, Vara Gwyn's face had set in hard lines. Her mother had pulled Atar into her bedchamber and demanded to know what had been the first day of her last cycle. There were worlds in the Federation where an event like this wouldn't have meant the end of Atar's life as she'd always known it. Girls and women her age and older, when confronted with an unplanned pregnancy, might have chosen whether or not to bear the child without fear of social repercussions or familial pressures. Technically, this was also true on Krios. It was considered a fundamental protection of all Federation citizens. It just didn't matter on Krios. No one blessed with a child on Gwyn's homeworld was permitted to do anything other than bear it and raise it. It was partly an issue of faith in the everlasting plan of the universe, and partly a social obligation. Birth rates among Creosians had plummeted in the last few centuries, and healthy children were the only thing standing between these proud people and their demise as a species. Her mother had asked, and Gwyn had known full well that the answer meant that there were no longer any choices about how she would spend the rest of her life. She and Jarek would be sealed in the local Degnar Tower, and from that day forward, her life would be forever intertwined with his. Even without the benefit of the rare metamorphic empathy a fraction of Creosians possessed, society would demand that they become each other's perfect mates and devote themselves entirely to the new life they had created. And young Atar Gwyn had known beyond doubt that in that life, she would die of boredom. In an instant, the only person she had ever considered spending the rest of her life with became a densely woven Harada cord, binding her irrevocably to a life she could not imagine living. She hadn't needed to share these thoughts with her mother. As with every thought Atar Gwyn ever had, her mother had read them clearly in her eyes. She'd returned to the kitchen and prepared tea for her. Atar hadn't been thirsty, but her mother had insisted she drink. For 2 weeks, the same tea greeted her each morning at breakfast. At dawn, 14 miserable days later, Atar had begun to bleed. Neither she nor her mother had ever spoken of the relief Atar felt. They had never spoken of the crime against nature Vara had committed in the interest of her only daughter's future happiness, or how her mother had known the recipe for ending an unwanted pregnancy. The only comment her mother had made that morning as Atar lay in her bed, her lower abdomen tensing with the most painful cramps she had ever felt, was, "Never again, my child." Atar had understood. This had been a gift of sorts. Her life had been restored to her. But the next time she missed a cycle, she would be expected to fulfill her obligations to her family and her people. After that, Atar had become possessed by a single notion. She had to leave Krios. She had to create a life for herself beyond the narrow borders limiting most of those who grew to adulthood on her homeworld. She had to find her own freedom. The following year, she tested for Starfleet Academy and was accepted. When Gwyn left, she'd never looked back. The experience hadn't soured her on enjoying physical intimacy with anyone except Jarek. If anything, it had increased her appetites. Freedom from her people's traditions wasn't simply a matter of geography. It was internal as well. She had learned to be careful, and as long as she was careful, she could taste of every conceivable physical delight without fear. The terror of this moment was in realizing with Sal's question that the life she had cherished for the last 6 years might have just come to an abrupt and irrevocable end. She had no sense that she was not alone in her body, but it might simply be too soon for that. Gwyn muttered.
A little over a week, maybe?
Can you be more specific?
Gwyn did the mental math.
12 days.
Sal released a sigh that sounded like relief.
That explains it.
Gwyn was afraid to ask what that was, or what it explained. All she could think of were the vials of blood Sal had taken 2 days prior, and the tests she must have performed on them.
I'm going to need a few more samples of your blood, Ensign, Sal finally said, if that's all right with you.
Why?
Gwyn whispered.
The cells I extracted showed evidence of the genetic sequences I need to cure the patient I told you about. But in the absence of certain hormones, the genes I require remain dormant.
So I'm not...
Gwyn began.
Not what?
Pregnant?
Gwyn asked. Sal chuckled. The gruff cackle was the most beautiful sound Gwyn had ever heard.
Of course not. I didn't know that was a concern.
Gwyn shook her head.
It isn't. I just couldn't imagine why you would need to know...
Apologies, Sal said warmly. This isn't the first time I've worked with Creosian tissue. I actually visited your home world 30 years ago, well before you were born. I made certain assumptions based on my prior experience, primarily that I could activate the necessary genes by using synthetic hormones to mimic the precise blood chemistry required. It turns out I can't. You're the only one who can do that. But the good news is, your body does it naturally every 36 days as you move through a normal cycle. So we have a couple of choices. Assuming you're still willing to help me, we can wait another 12 days until the necessary hormonal changes occur naturally within your body. Or I can give you an injection that will induce the changes now, and you can give me another few vials of blood day after tomorrow.
Gwyn considered the alternatives.
Does it matter for your patient?
Sal nodded somberly.
Actually, it does. Every day that goes by is another day of damage done to her body. I hate to wait, but if you're not comfortable with the idea of the injection, that's okay. It's not unlike some of the synthetic compounds we use for annual injections to repress your cycle. There won't be any side effects beyond shortening the length of this one. It will end a few weeks early. But that happens normally in a woman's body every so often.
Her? Gwyn asked.
Sal paused. Her face shut down like a room where the lights have just been turned off.
It's Lieutenant Conlon, isn't it?
Gwyn asked.
Does it matter?
Gwyn turned away. Everyone on Voyager knew that Conlon had taken a medical leave. Everyone knew that at roughly the same time, Lieutenant Kim had gone from being one of the more approachable and generous senior officers to busting the balls of anyone who stepped even a hair out of line. Even with her mild and intermittent natural empathic abilities, Gwyn could feel the tense, sick knot he carried in his stomach wherever he went these days. It wasn't hard to connect those dots. Gwyn didn't need to know the specifics. Sal had been right about one thing. Voyager... This fleet had become a new sort of family to Gwyn. They had replaced the one she'd left behind on Krios. She didn't need it to be a permanent situation. In fact, she knew it wouldn't be. Very few Starfleet careers ended on the same ship where they'd begun. But that didn't change what it was now, or Gwyn's appreciation for the tenuous bonds that bound them all. She thought of Patel, and her naked envy of the particular closeness of their ship's senior officers. Gwyn had never felt the same need to share in that unique camaraderie, but she also took comfort in its existence. Anything that threatened them threatened the whole ship. It was little enough Gwyn could do to try and make the lives of her fellow officers a little easier.
It doesn't, Gwyn finally said, but it's nice to know who I'm helping.
I can't confirm,
Sal began.
You don't need to, Gwyn insisted.
I'm scheduled to pilot a shuttle for 7 over the next few days, so go ahead. Let's do this now. Relief washed over Sal's face. Behind it, something else stirred. Gwyn could not say for certain. She didn't have her mother's deep empathic abilities. Still, Gwyn was suddenly conscious that while everything Sal had just told her was true, there was a great deal the doctor wasn't saying. DK-1116. Biodome 10 was almost ready to start receiving the first groups of crew members on shore leave rotations. The lake, as Commander Tom Paris had taken to calling the vast, still pool of water at its center, was crystal clear, and by some unknown mechanism maintained a temperature just below that of a normal human body. It was as close as Paris had come to a natural hot spring since his family had toured Yellowstone when he was 12. A narrow white beach composed primarily of silica edged the water all around. The floor was a gentle slope that bottomed out around 2 kilometers. Beyond the beach to the southeast was a wide plain covered with silky grass. To the north, the forest began. The tall, metallic, braided poles branched out like massive oaks near the tops, giving way to wide, flat tendrils, some of which were small enough to look more like platinum leaves. They were warm to the touch, but not too hot. Beneath them, a wider variety of flora bloomed, most in dark blues and grays. Patches of tall white fronds were interspersed. These were the only hostile life form, in that any bits that brushed against a black uniform tended to cling mercilessly to the fabric, becoming quite sticky. Paris had already decided that the pants he'd worn for the first several hours of preparation were unsalvageable and would have to be recycled. But apart from this incredibly minor inconvenience, the site was perfect. Dozens of replicated beach chairs were set up beneath wide umbrellas. Crates of blankets and towels were ready for sunbathing. Those who intended to stay the night, like Paris, had been told to provide their own camping gear. His family tent was already set up on a small plateau about 20 meters from the water. Out of deference to the carefully controlled ecosystem, no campfires would be permitted, but Paris had brought down a portable heater with exposed coils that would be perfect for roasting hot dogs and marshmallows, or whatever version of those two delicacies the replicator could manage. 2 large semi-permanent structures had been erected to house the provisions that had been sent down. Crates filled with a diverse menu of replicated snacks and ration bars were present, with large cisterns of water. Inside the smaller base, Tom had installed a portable replicator, ostensibly for emergency medical needs, but the 15 extra battery packs B'Elanna had scrounged up from Vesta's stocks ensured that the replicator could and likely would be used to create more exotic food and beverages once the recreating really began. Lieutenant Ranson Velf, Galen's chief of security, and Lieutenant Commander Atlee Fife of Demeter had assisted Paris for the last several hours in making these preparations. Velf had already traded his uniform for a pair of shorts and a t-shirt and was wading along the water's edge, while Fife sat on a nearby beach chair fiddling with a tricorder.
"Gentlemen," Paris said, approaching them, "I believe we're ready to face the hordes."
"I don't know, Paris," Velf said. "I think at least one more security sweep might be in order."
"Of what?" Paris asked.
"Did any of our advance teams check out the water?"
Velf asked. He looked serious, but his light tone couldn't quite sell the concern.
"They scanned it, but you're probably right. Someone needs to give it a try."
"Fife!"
Velf called.
"Yes, Lieutenant?"
the gangly young man asked, looking up.
"Can you give me a hand here?"
"Of course,"
Fife said, setting his tricorder aside and joining Paris at the water's edge. The next thing Paris knew, Velf had grabbed him under the shoulders and was lifting him from the ground. Without missing a beat, Fife secured his legs.
"You know what they say, Mr. Paris?"
Velf said good-naturedly.
Paris struggled, knowing full well it was futile.
Suddenly he was 11 again, at a family reunion at Lake Shasta. He'd been a scrawny kid then, no match for his older cousins who had decided to make the Admiral's only son the butt of all their jokes and pranks.
"That assaulting a superior officer is a great way to get your shore leave revoked?"
Paris asked.
"He's right, Fife,"
Velf said.
"Let him go."
Paris could see Fife's face.
"Of course, sir. Apologies."
On three?
They counted together, swinging Paris between them. At their mark, Paris found himself flying through the air. Paris had never allowed his inner child to wander too far from home. It got a lot of play these days when he was caring for Miral and Michael. It was rare, however, for men closer to his age to give rein to the younger selves, the boys they had been before the academy and Starfleet service wore down the rough edges. As he hit the water, Paris decided he was going to enjoy making Fife and Velth pay for this. The water wasn't too deep, but as soon as he entered it, Paris felt for the bottom. Letting the last of the air out of his lungs and grasping for the sand, he floated beneath the surface, waiting for the right moment. It took 15 seconds for Fife and Velth to begin to worry enough to start wading toward him. Paris darted forward and grabbed Fife around the ankles, dragging him under before breaking the surface to catch his breath. Fife bobbed up quickly and got his feet under him. Velth stood nearby, his hands on his knees, laughing at both of them. A simple look exchanged between Paris and Fife cemented their alliance. Both of them rose from the water, their uniforms soaked and clinging in uncomfortable places, and after a brief game of chase, they had wrestled Velth to the ground and tossed him into the water. Paris clambered back toward the shore, and as the water receded to about waist deep, he bent over, breathing heavy.
"When the hell did I get this out of shape?" he asked.
Fife and Velth were treading water several meters deeper, but both stared with blank faces over Paris's shoulder.
"What's this?" a familiar voice asked. "The best 2 out of 3?
Paris turned to see B'Elanna standing near the water's edge, holding Miral by one hand. Michael was strapped to her body in a sling.
"Daddy, you forgot your swimsuit,"
Miral chastised him.
"I was going to leave these two with you and cover engineering for a few more hours, but now I'm not so sure,"
Torres said. It was a struggle for Paris to pull himself and his drenched uniform the last few meters out of the water, but he managed.
"No, no," he said. "You go. I've got this."
"Are you sure?"
"Don't I look sure?"
Torres shook her head.
"You look like you lost a bet."
Paris started to wrap his dripping arms around her. Then he realized that Michael would get soaked first and opted to simply lean in and kiss his wife tenderly.
"Still love me anyway?"
Torres patted his cheek.
"Just keep them alive until I get back. I'll bring dinner."
"Did you pack me a suit?"
"It should be in the tent."
"Give me 5 minutes to change."
Torres nodded as Miral began to inch toward the water. Paris started toward their temporary encampment, but turned back as he heard his daughter cry out in delight.
"Mommy, look!"
She stood only ankle deep in the lake, but a few meters beyond her, multicolored lights flashed over the water, forming a small rainbow. A smile bright enough to light the sky lit his daughter's face. Young Tom Paris had made it his mission in life to taste every delight available from the Federation's most exotic worlds. The fragrant fields of Artan, the soft-packed snow on the mountains of Mons Tianus, the pools of tranquility on Saranjai, and an entire menu of delights on Risa. That day, Commander Tom Paris decided that the waters of an unnamed planet in the Delta Quadrant, seen through his daughter's eyes, put them all to shame. Catherine Janeway hadn't felt her mind hum with the heady anticipation of discovery in a long time.
"This is the problem with promotions," she decided. "They never tell you this is what you're sacrificing for the good of Starfleet, because if they did, no one would ever accept the offer."
After spending a couple of hours walking over the surface of the massive metal plate, the command officers had broken into two groups to explore the areas directly north and south of the construct. Janeway and Chakotay took the southern forest, planning to take samples of the soil and plant life, while O'Donnell, Farkas, and Glenn set off to scout the northern plain. The temperature dropped slightly inside the blue forest. Janeway had half expected that the opposite would be true. According to her scans, however, despite the presence of several pools scattered ahead and the generally warm temperature, there simply wasn't enough humidity in the atmosphere to create a tropical climate. Instead, the shade of the wide leaves that capped the trees simply blocked some of the ambient heat, creating a comfortably cool interior. Chakotay had paused to examine an outgrowth of long, thin red fronds that burst forth from the base of a nearby tree. For her part, Janeway kept turning over O'Donnell's analysis in her mind.
This isn't how nature works. One or more of these species should have conquered the rest and thrown this entire ecosystem out of balance. But they hadn't. 4,000 years later, these life forms seemed designed to simply maintain the status quo.
But life, at least as she understood it, just didn't do that.
Except when it did.
Watching Chakotay remove small samples of the soil and foliage around the base of the tree, Janeway thought back to the instinctive reluctance she felt a few days earlier when she thought Chakotay might have intended to propose to her.
Where did that come from?
It was fair to say that since their relationship had transformed from platonic to physically intimate, they'd suffered several setbacks. Trust did not seem to come as easily to either of them as their long shared history might suggest it should. That lack was at the heart of all of their recent disagreements. At first, she had believed it had to do with their respective positions within the fleet. During the time that she had been presumed deceased, Chakotay had taken ownership of his command. He rightly chafed against any order or decision she made that put them in what he perceived as unnecessary jeopardy. When she'd had his job, she'd been as merciless with the Admiralty as he was now. But since she was an admiral, and he knew her devotion to be no less than his, she had assumed this was one set of battles they could avoid. They hadn't. He had fought her at so many steps along the way during her first months leading the fleet. He had made assumptions that wounded her deeply, partially accurate as they may have been. More important, he had either lied directly to her or withheld information that was critical to their mission when he wasn't absolutely certain how she would respond. And yet each and every time, they had found their way back to each other's arms. Neither of them had seemed able or willing to upset the status quo. They were moving into the future together, but it was hard to see that motion as forward progress. Was that what she feared? Were she and Chakotay only able to maintain what they'd built together in an uneasy stasis? Was this the only future she could envision for them?
"I don't think these are living organisms," Chakotay said, startling her from her reverie. "I think they are incredibly well-preserved fossils."
She moved to the base of the tree he was scanning with his tricorder.
"Don't they scan as life forms?"
He shook his head.
"Inconclusive. There are traces of what might be remnants of ancient DNA. O'Donnell seemed to think these species were designed to grow incredibly slowly, but I wonder if these are actually dead."
"But he also said that they are critical to maintaining the ecosystem, the conversion of radiant energy and oxygen to carbon dioxide. They couldn't do that if they were dead, could they?"
"Maybe only a small percentage regulate the atmosphere," Chakotay posited.
Janeway moved to the next closest specimen, a thick blue trunk with distinct rings around it spaced roughly 10 centimeters apart. She took baseline readings with her tricorder and found the same confusing results Chakotay had described, essentially lifeless life form. Setting her phaser on its lowest setting, she cut a small square segment from the trunk 6 centimeters deep and placed it in a small vial for later analysis.
"We'll see what the microspectrometers back on Voyager make of it," she began, but paused when a low, crinkling sound met her ears. "Chakotay, do you have a Sims beacon handy?" she asked.
He brought her the small light and focused it on the area from which she had extracted the sample. She set the vial aside and again focused her tricorder on the damaged section. Under the bright illumination of the beacon, they watched together as small blue filaments emerged from the heart of the incision, weaving and coiling around one another until, a few minutes later, it was almost impossible to tell that there had been any damage to the organism at all. Janeway's heart was racing. Without thought, she took Chakotay's hand. He squeezed hers in return, a small gesture of comfort and commiseration.
"Not dead,"
she said softly.
but not living either, he added.
She lifted her eyes to his, searching for a classification in which to place the minor miracle.
Zombie? She ventured.
A smile of genuine amusement lit his face.
That would be a new one for us.
We need to try that again, she said.
They moved through the forest together, taking several more samples of 6 different strains of plant life. Each one was obviously a distinct species. None of them scanned as living until they were damaged and the repair process began. Once it was complete, they reverted to the strange, indeterminate readings they generated when inert. Oddly, none of the samples they extracted exhibited the same regenerative properties. Once their work was done, they set a steady pace back toward the metal plate, brimming with hypotheses and eagerly anticipating the reports of the rest of their team. When they reached the edge of the zombie forest, as it would now forever be known, Chakotay retrieved 2 full canteens, and they slaked their thirst gratefully. In the distance, Farkas and Glenn could be seen approaching.
What do we have? Janeway said once they were met. And where is Commander O'Donnell?
About 2 clicks north, there's a string of low hills, Glenn reported. He wanted to check several unique plants growing there. Or not growing.
I can't speak for the rest of you, but I'm not sleeping on the surface of this planet tonight or ever, Farkas said.
Why not?
Chakotay asked.
It's not right, Farkas replied. I don't know what this place is, but it's just not right.
Several of the plants we examined have an unusual capacity for regeneration, Glenn said. It's the most amazing thing.
I know, Janeway said, grinning.
You saw it too? Farkas demanded.
I'm dying to know what O'Donnell makes of it, Chakotay added.
Well, you should feel free to ask him, Farkas said. Myself? I just think it's spooky.
But it explains so much, Janeway said, her thrill at their discovery not diminished in the slightest by Farkas's fears. This may very well be an entirely new kind of life form.
One we don't have the slightest idea how to communicate with or tame, Farkas said. To my mind, that makes them dangerous.
They're just plants, Regina, Glenn insisted. They can't hurt you.
How do you know that? How many plants have you seen elsewhere that can repair themselves quicker than you can cut them down?
None, Glenn said. But even on Earth, there are many regenerative life forms. Worms, lizards, starfish. This isn't an unprecedented biological phenomenon.
All those things are definitely alive, Farkas countered. Our tricorders don't even know what to call the grass we're standing on right now. It all reads as inert.
We're going to get to the bottom of this, Captain, Janeway said gently.
Excellent. I look forward to reading your report when you do. In the meantime, I'm going to head back to Vesta and make sure we've got clear transport locks on all of our away teams. I know we can't cancel shore leave because this place gives me the willies, but I want to make damn sure our people can be pulled out the minute this goes pear-shaped.
A wise precaution, Janeway agreed. But if O'Donnell is making camp for us, at least come back and join us for dinner in a few hours.
Is that an order, Admiral?
No. A request. Part of the point of this exercise is for us to share our unique perspectives and insights. That will be hard to do from Vesta.
Farkas sighed.
Very well. Dinner. But no promises on dessert.
A few moments later, Farkas disappeared in the glowing cascade of the transporter effect.
It's unusual, isn't it? Glenn said. To see someone whose career has been as long and storied as hers, so affected by a strange natural phenomenon.
Don't judge her too harshly, Janeway suggested. We are trained to respect our gut instincts. That's all she's doing.
You think she's right? Do you believe anything here poses a serious danger to us? Chakotay asked.
No, Janeway replied. Actually, whatever this is, I don't think it is the slightest bit interested in us.
For now, Chakotay said.
8. DK-1116. The slow and steady march from the edge of the stepwell down to the water had been challenging. Standard-issue wetsuits were designed to breathe out of the water and conserve maximum body heat once submerged. Even the newest versions of these marvels were better at the second than the first. In the past, when suits were worn for extended durations on shore, it was a simple matter to cool down by removing the boots. Even before Ensign Vincent had provided a practical demonstration, Devi Patel understood that wasn't an option. In fact, she had insisted that both Lazarin and Japel also wear their gloves as they made their way down the narrow ledges, just in case they needed to use their hands for balancing as they descended. By the time they came within safe jumping distance, the faces of all three were plastered with sweat and their breathing had become labored.
"Take a minute before you put your masks on to calm your breath," Patel ordered.
She understood that her fellow officers were meant to be working as a team. As long as they did so in the manner she required, she would welcome their input. But someone had to take charge in situations like this, and her rank and experience gave her that privilege. Japel and Lazarin merely nodded, wiped the sheen of sweat from their brows, and collected themselves briefly before donning their portable rebreathing units.
"Vincent, are you reading us?" Patel asked through the mask's comm unit.
"Loud and clear, Lieutenant. I'm showing unsaturated filters on all three units and full tanks. You should be able to descend to a depth of 50 meters for a maximum of half an hour."
"You'll signal us when we hit 20 minutes, right?"
Japel asked.
"Sure thing, Omar,"
Vincent replied.
"As soon as we're in, check your depth gauges and start your dive clocks," Patel said. "The water is unusually pure, but it will be really dark down there. Activate your lamps now."
Both Lazarin and Japel turned on the bright beacons attached above their masks. They would wait to activate their SIMS beacons until required. These preparations complete, Patel nodded to Lazarin, stepped to the edge of the nearest ledge, and pushed off, easily clearing the remaining steps between her and the water below. She expected to feel the sudden brisk relief of cold water, but was surprised to find that the temperature was exceedingly warm. Two splashes to either side of her alerted her to the arrival of Lazarin and Japel. They took a minute to orient themselves in relation to one another, extended the short fins embedded in the soles of their dive boots, and as a group began their descent. 15 meters down, the steps became wider. This was no surprise. These features had been prominent from the first sensor scans Patel had reviewed. As she made her way along the wall, she searched diligently for any sign of an opening.
"Why is this water so warm?"
Japel asked.
"It doesn't appear to be that deep,"
Lazarin said. Aiming his right hand ahead of him, he pointed out a wide ledge roughly 20 meters below.
"Maybe it retains the heat generated on the surface by the energy fields."
"That's not the bottom," Patel advised.
"No, but it's unusually large,"
Lazarin said.
"I'm going to check it out."
"We should remain together and circle the well at this depth for any entrance to the caverns beneath," Patel said.
"We've only got half an hour, Devi,"
Lazarin said. Even through the processing of the comm unit, she could hear the calm certainty of his voice.
"Let's not waste time arguing."
"It's not possible to be too careful diving in unfamiliar waters," Patel retorted.
"Fine. Japel, stay with Devi,"
Lazarin said. Before Patel could argue, Lazarin began to swim toward the large ledge. Biting back the urge to descent, Patel continued to move slowly through the water above him, Japel following a few meters deeper. They had barely completed their first circuit around the well when Lazarin's voice crackled through the comm.
"Holy rings of Beta Zed. Devi, get down here."
It only took a few seconds for Patel to see where Lazarin waited. His head and wrist beacons guided her and Japel down to his position. As soon as she reached him, Lazarin gestured to the wall just below the large ledge that had been his target. With the light of his beacons playing off it, the otherwise pitch-black surface appeared to glow. A metallic substance braided throughout the silica gleamed back at them like a massive vein of silver or platinum. Patel swam toward the wall and, securing herself on the ledge, shined her beacons across the well. Even though the far wall was at least 50 meters away, the faint glimmer told her that at this depth, all of the walls were composed largely of this metallic substance.
"Good work, Lazarin,"
Patel commended him.
Lieutenant? Japel said.
What? Both Patel and Lazarin answered in unison. Japel was playing his light over an area 10 meters down that looked like a wide oval shadow running along the next step below. It was only easy to see because of the obvious contrast with the otherwise metallic surface. Patel started to swim toward it, but Lazarin grabbed her by her left ankle.
Check your dive gauge, Devi. We're already at 50 meters and 17 minutes elapsed. We need to allow for a few decompression stops during our ascent.
If it leads to an internal cavern, we can run more detailed sensor scans while we're back up top. I don't want to waste any time.
You also don't want to spend the next few days in a recompression chamber,
Lazarin insisted.
You guys head back. I'll just be a minute, Patel insisted.
Lazarin looked to Japel, who had already ascended a few meters.
No way. If we do this, we do it together. Lieutenant, and here, Vincent, he's on,
came Vincent's voice, crackling through her mask. Clearly the metallic deposits were interfering with their signal.
Japel, go ahead and get back to the surface. Report our status to Vincent and make sure he's prepared to request an emergency transport. Lazarin, with me.
Patel's dive gauge put her depth at 60 meters when she reached the shadow on the wall. Only it wasn't a shadow. It was an opening, easily wide enough to swim into. At most, she had 3 minutes to explore before she had to begin her ascent or risk decompression sickness. The smart move would have been to follow Lazarin's advice and return to this position in an hour. Patel was tired of playing it safe.
I'm going in, she said.
Right behind you, boss,
Lazarin said. The cavern was long and wide. Even with her beacons at maximum illumination, she couldn't see an end. The walls practically glowed, so dense were the metallic deposits within. It became harder and harder to shake the illusion that she was swimming through the remains of a massive vessel rather than a natural cave system. A low warning alarm sounded over Devi's comm channel.
That's it, Devi. Time to go,
Lazarin said. Patel checked her gauge. The good news was that despite the fact that she had seemed to be swimming more or less along a flat plane, she had actually begun to slowly ascend. She and Lazarin were already at 50 meters. The bad news was that she had less than 9 minutes of air remaining, and she would need most of them for a safe ascent. There was a good chance this cavern would end in nothing but a solid wall. Given that, she should definitely head back. But either her gut or her pride insisted that this was the entrance to the cavern system Lazarin's latest scans had shown.
Just a few more meters, Patel said.
She didn't look back to see if Lazarin was following her. Somehow she knew he was. If she ended up being wrong about this, she could easily be killing both of them. This was the moment. This was the place where officers who never got very far in Starfleet played by the rules and followed orders. People like Seven and Admiral Janeway and Captain Chakotay talked a good game about personal responsibility and security, but Patel knew in her bones that the line between reckless and legendary was damned thin. She forged ahead. Checking her gauge again, she clocked her continuing ascent.
35 meters.
And 4 minutes of air left. Just enough for a rapid ascent, emergency transport, and a day in a recompression chamber. Lazarin had come up beside her. In a universal signal, he pointed upward with his thumb. Patel looked up and saw nothing but blackness above. Despite this, Lazarin allowed his feet to float down and began a steady ascent. Patel followed and, with less than 2 minutes of breathable air left in her unit, broke the surface of the water. Lazarin pulled a tricorder from his belt and removed it from its watertight case. After a quick scan, he removed his diving mask and rebreathing unit. Patel did the same. Playing her wrist beacon around her, she realized that they had entered a massive cavern filled with breathable air. 20 meters beyond their position was a shoreline. Side by side, they made haste to claim it. Once they were seated on the ground, Lazarin said,
That's the dumbest thing I've ever done.
Me too, Patel agreed. Isn't it great?
Lieutenant Cress Benoit was tall and exceedingly thin. He towered above Bryce and Icheb. His skin was deep ebony, and despite, or perhaps because of, a faintly visible receding hairline, he kept his scalp clean-shaven. He was quick to smile, and his large brown eyes had a particular intensity that was faintly unnerving to Lieutenant Bryce. When he spoke to you, he often appeared to be searching your face for every possible micro-gesture's deeper meaning. However long that moment lasted, you had no doubt that you held his full attention. As Galen's chief engineer, Benoit's duties, apart from maintaining the ship's power and propulsion systems, consisted largely of managing the first generation of specialized engineering holograms. Bryce was fascinated by this new technological marvel and peppered Benoit with question after question while the three of them hiked toward the edge of their biodome, where Elkins awaited them to compare the results of their initial scans. Apparently, Demeter's chief was already hard at work directly testing the energy field that sustained the biodome.
"Do they ever complain?" Bryce asked Benoit.
Deep dimples framed Benoit's lips in prelude to his response.
"Not so far. They accept any order I give them with the polite deference and enthusiasm you would expect from any junior officer."
"Enthusiasm?"
"Barclay indicated that some of the older Mark I's had temperament issues that could be misconstrued as disrespectful. He said it was an issue with the template they had tried very hard to correct in each successive generation. I think they were trying to err toward the positive, but the result is a little uncanny. They seem pleasant enough, but it's forced. No one is that happy to retune a magnetic constrictor."
Bryce glanced toward Icheb, whose brow had furrowed despite keeping his eyes locked on his tricorder.
"Something you want to add, Icheb?"
"No, sir," he replied stiffly.
Bryce couldn't put his finger on any particular cause, but there was something strained in Icheb's manner since they'd arrived on the planet. That was unusual in Finn's admittedly limited experience with the ensign. He wondered if Icheb had taken offense at the Seven of Nanonium thing. Bryce knew well that Seven and the holographic doctor were two of Icheb's closest confidants. Perhaps he had unintentionally put his friend on the defensive.
"Voyager's doctor was a Mark I, wasn't he? You know him better than either of us," Bryce said, hoping to draw Icheb out.
"I think some people confuse competence with unearned superiority. It is true, in my experience, that the doctor does not suffer fools, but his concern and compassion for his patients is sincere. I believe that when he was first activated, his program was limited by the expectations of his designers. No one imagined that he would be required to take the place of his human counterpart full-time. What I find most impressive about him is that over time he expanded his knowledge and experiences with the intention of becoming a better doctor. He continues to do so even now. I wonder, Lieutenant Benoit, if you have observed any similar capacity in the holograms you supervise. Have any of them, in your opinion, exceeded their initial programming?"
Benoit seemed to consider the question seriously.
"I can't honestly say that they have. I believe it is the hope of Lieutenant Barclay that at some point they will. But I'm not sure even he understands what spark of inspiration led to the evolution you have described in our CMO. We're talking about sentience, yes?"
"Yes," Icheb said.
"Do you honestly believe that should be the intention here?" Bryce asked. "Holograms are incredibly powerful tools. But if all of them could be made like your doctor, to evolve into sentient beings, that's the end of their utility. With sentience comes individual rights. We would require their consent in order to keep them in service."
"What leads you to believe that most of them wouldn't wish to continue their service? The doctor certainly has,"
Icheb countered.
"The doctor is unique. He possesses technology that grants him autonomy. The holograms Chief Benoit uses can only exist within the confines of the Galen. Until we master the specs on that mobile emitter, the life of any other sentient hologram would be little more than benign imprisonment."
"There's another issue as well,"
Benoit added.
"While they are extremely competent workers, you've never seen an engine room as meticulously maintained as mine, and I'm not taking all the credit for that. They aren't the best companions. I have three full-time organic engineers, and we have to rotate shifts, so usually only one of us is on duty at a time. It affects morale. We make sure to grab as many hours off duty together as we can, and to mingle with the rest of the organic crew members. Without that, it would be a pretty lonely job.
Perhaps if you made more of an effort to get to know them,
Icheb suggested.
Time will tell, Ensign, but I fear that the Doctor may end up being the exception that proves the rule. Holograms are useful, but can never replace flesh-and-blood crew.
And even if they could, Bryce added, would we want them to? We build these ships so that we can throw ourselves out among the stars. We seek to expand our knowledge, to experience things others never will. If holograms could do that work for us too, who's to say we wouldn't begin to decline as a species?
Icheb paused in his steps to stare at both of them. Crimson began to creep over his fair face.
I believe in the essential wisdom of the notion of infinite diversity and infinite combinations. The evolution of other species does not have to limit ours. Existence is not a zero-sum equation. For others to gain the self-awareness of the Doctor might also lead us to an expanded understanding of the nature of consciousness. Surely that is a goal as worthy of pursuit as our understanding of the composition of the rest of the universe.
Bryce could see that he had unintentionally wounded Icheb. Thinking before he spoke had never been one of his strengths. He didn't believe his argument was wrong, but he hated to think that Icheb believed he harbored any sort of racist or speciesist tendencies. Before he could think of a way to correct the misconception, Benoit said,
"You might be right, Ensign. I'd like to think you are. But don't judge those of us whose understanding is limited by our experiences too harshly. You were Borg once, weren't you?"
"I was."
"You have been granted a perspective few others can ever know. You have lived as an individual and as part of a technologically enhanced collective. I can easily see that your definition of consciousness would be different from mine, that those boundaries I take for granted mean nothing to you. Part of the reason we are here, working together, is to facilitate exchanges like this. But you mustn't take offense at my limitations. Rather, you might help me expand them."
This seemed to mollify Icheb considerably.
"Took the three of you long enough,"
a gruff voice interrupted. Lieutenant Elkins, Demeter's chief engineer, trudged toward them over the rocky terrain that edged the biodome. Beyond him, a faint shimmer like heat rising from the ground was the only visible sign of the barrier that stood between the officers and the rough and wild surface of the unprotected portions of the planet. A storm raged outside this dome, kicking up swirls of red and gray dust over jagged rocks that burst forth from the soil like the gnarled hands of a giant. Bryce's many inadequacies slipped to the section of his mind marked for further study as the fragility of his existence within the biodome rushed to the forefront.
"Dear gods,"
Benoit said, a note of awe suffusing his voice, which Bryce echoed silently.
"Chief Elkins will do, Cress,"
the portly man in his late 50s said cheerfully. His head was covered with thick waves of wiry black and gray hair, and his skin was a rich tan that suggested overexposure to the sun. His hazel eyes were alight with energy. He seemed invigorated by the subject of their inquiry rather than unnerved by it. He shook each of their hands in turn with a meaty fist, then said,
"Let me guess. None of you picked up any readings of this field's generator?"
"No, sir,"
Benoit was the first to reply. Icheb and Bryce quickly added their negatives.
"Do you want to know why?"
Elkins asked brightly.
"Absolutely," Bryce said.
"Come here,"
Elkins said, motioning them over to the edge of the energy field. He then lifted his tricorder so that all three could see the display. The closer the device came to the field, the more intense the energy readings.
"Now watch this," he said.
Without warning, Elkins stepped to the edge of the field and then beyond it.
"Wait!"
Icheb called out in instinctive fear. Reason told Bryce that Elkins should already be dead. The unprotected surface of DK-1116 was a toxic wasteland with temperatures well above 200 degrees Celsius when facing the suns. And that was before you added the exotic radiation pummeling the planet at all times, given its relative proximity to the binaries. Never mind the absence of atmosphere. And yet, miraculously, Elkins stood there, almost 2 meters beyond the border of the field, in perfect health. The ground beneath his feet was the same rough red as the rest of the unprotected surface, but apparently none of the toxic atmosphere had found its way inside as the field had expanded. Either that, or it had somehow been immediately filtered by the field.
"The field expanded to accommodate your presence," Benoit said. "It is aware of you and your movements, and is designed to keep you alive."
Elkins smiled broadly.
"Yep."
"Could you step back inside, please?"
Icheb asked, his voice tight.
"Join me, Icheb,"
Elkins suggested instead.
"Don't be afraid, son."
It was a challenge, and if only to save face, Icheb would swallow his fear and accept. Moving like a man condemned, he did as Elkins had suggested, and paused only briefly before stepping beyond the apparent boundary of the field. A faint smile played over his face as it dawned on him that he, too, had survived.
"Now look at this,"
Elkins said, raising his tricorder for Icheb to see.
"The field strength has intensified along a 45-degree axis," Icheb said.
"Do you see?"
Elkins asked.
"In order to accommodate this geometry, the field generator must be located several miles below the surface."
"If we think of this not as a dome, but as a sphere of energy, its source has to be roughly 10 kilometers down beneath the absolute center of the area,"
Elkins agreed.
"Based on the placement of the other domes..."
"A single generator creates and sustains all of them,"
Icheb finished for him. Elkins clapped the top of Icheb's shoulder.
"Brilliant, isn't it?"
"So I guess we're not going to dig it up,"
Benoit said, clearly disappointed. Elkins sighed, stepping back inside the normal boundary, Icheb following on his heels.
"I'll admit I'd give anything to take it apart. But to do so would be to endanger the entire ecosystem, and I'm not comfortable with that."
"Now that we know where to look, with properly placed sensors in each biodome, we might at least be able to get a schematic of the design and more precise readings of its power distribution,"
Bryce suggested.
"It will take at least a few days to replicate and place those sensors,"
Benoit noted.
"You gentlemen have somewhere else you'd rather be?"
Elkins asked. Bryce did, but held his peace. Instead, he shook his head along with Icheb and Benoit.
"No, sir."
Galen.
"When Tama was not much older than you are now, he met Drac.
They spent their days running wild beneath the Harrier blossoms and sucking the juice from the Siamate until their fingers were stained Rahar. They knew themselves to be brothers. Drac's mother feared that one day she would lose her son to Tama's people because she was not one of them. She decided to return to her home across the ocean. But Tama could not bear to be separated from his brother forever. He wrapped himself in Drac's ashen yar and presented himself to Drac's mother, saying, 'I am ready to return to our home as you bid me.' They journeyed several sets across the ocean, and when they finally reached Drac's home, Tama was brought before Drac's family, who stared at him, unable to believe their eyes. 'This cannot be Drac,' they said. 'How is it possible that you do not know your own son?' Tama said, 'Your eyes deceive you. Do not trust them. This woman knows the truth.' Only then did she understand that the differences between her people and Tama's were so insignificant as to be meaningless. The fear that had driven her to separate Tama and Drac was the lie. She fell to her knees before Tama and asked, 'Is there a place for me among your people?' Tama took her hands in his and said, 'You are my mother as surely as Drac is my brother. There is no place in the world where that is not true.' She smiled at Tama and begged his forgiveness. Together, she and Tama returned across the ocean and were reunited with Drac. She lived among them in peace for the rest of her days, and when her eyes closed for the last time, she was still smiling. 'You are truly blessed to be born into a universe where this truth, Tama and Drac at Myana, is already known by so many, little one,'
Dr. Sherrick said, placing his hands against the gestational incubator where Lieutenant Conlon's child floated.
What the hell?
Sherrick turned to see Lieutenant Kim hovering in the doorway.
He immediately understood the lieutenant's disorientation. That morning, Sherrick had discovered a unique property of the doctor's medical bay. Several of the treatment rooms, including this one, were also mini holodecks. They were installed to allow patients to access a number of peaceful, scenic environments during recovery.